March 19th, 2013, 3 p.m., Hearing Room D, House Committee on Energy and Environment.
We'll come to order.
Welcome, committee members. We are going to start with, because we do not have a quorum, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2048, continuing from last time around. And I'd like to call forward Palmer Mason and Abby Buderis. Whichever one of you would like to start may begin.
I'll start. Chair Bailey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason, Government Relations Manager with DEQ, here to talk about House Bill 2048. Actually, Abby Buderis is not here today. I have with me Cheryl Grabham. She's a solid waste analyst at the department, and she will be helping me as we talk through this bill. We are providing a handout to the committee, and if I can, take a moment to tell you a bit about that handout. One side of it is a chart that describes the performance of the program compared to a year, 2009, which is the year before the start of the program, the launch of the program, and then it shows you 2011, which is the first full year of the program, and we'll talk more about the chart in detail. On the back side of the handout is a description of some of the key issues related to this bill, and I wanted to be sure the committee had this because the amendment is still being worked on, and I know it's difficult to be talking about a bill and it's going to be amended and you don't have the amendment in front of you, so this was our next best approach, was to provide this handout so you had some sense of the issues and the discussion items under each of those issues. So that's the purpose of the handout, and we'll talk more about it in detail. But I'm going to let Cheryl start if we may.
Please.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Cheryl Grabham. I'm a policy analyst in the solid waste program at DEQ. Last Thursday, you heard from several people about the PAINT program, but it may be useful to review the context for House Bill 2048. PAINT poses risks to human health and the environment if it's not properly managed. Historically, PAINT has been the largest volume material collected at household hazardous waste programs, resulting in significant costs to locally funded programs. The PAINT Product Stewardship Pilot Program in Oregon was established by House Bill 3037 in the year 2009. With the passage of that bill, Oregon became the very first state with an architectural PAINT product stewardship law. The program has been running for more than 2.5 years now and is scheduled to sunset in 2014. Legislation has since passed in California, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, with bills pending or proposed in several other states. In a nutshell, here's how the program works. Under the pilot program, people and businesses can take their unwanted paint back to collection sites across the state at no cost. In order to sell architectural paint in Oregon, paint manufacturers must participate in a statewide stewardship program. The stewardship organization must submit a program plan to DEQ that provides convenient collection in urban and rural areas of the state and a funding mechanism that includes an assessment added to the cost of all paint sold in Oregon. The fee is currently 75 cents per gallon, and that varies by container size. Because the law provides antitrust protection to the paint industry to unilaterally set the paint assessment charged on all containers of paint sold in Oregon, DEQ must provide careful oversight of the program budget. DEQ has two primary roles: to review and approve the assessment, and to approve and oversee the program plan and its implementation. The law also requires annual reporting by the stewardship organization to DEQ, and it required DEQ to submit a legislative report in 2011. I'll talk about that more in a moment. In short, the program is paid for by Oregonians who buy paint, managed by the paint industry, and overseen by DEQ. Last week, representatives from the American Coatings Association presented results.
Could you just back up just a little bit from the microphone? It'll distort less. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Last week, representatives from the American Coatings Association presented results from the first 2 years of the program, but I will provide a few highlights from DEQ's perspective. In the first 2 years, Pinker established more than 85 new collection sites, bringing the number of collection sites in Oregon to more than 100 today, and providing more convenient collection opportunities for many Oregonians. The program processed more than 900,000 gallons of leftover paint during the first 2 years, and local governments have saved significant amounts of money in transportation and disposal costs. Now I'll draw your attention to Figure 1 in this handout. This summarizes data DEQ recently analyzed, and it shows how paint collection has changed in Oregon since the program began. The left-hand bar represents paint collected in calendar year 2009 before the pilot program. The right-hand bar is for calendar year 2011, the first full year of the pilot program. The first bar shows that in 2009, 5 million pounds of paint and containers were collected in Oregon through locally operated programs. This is all paint collected in the state and includes the containers that the paint is packaged in. The second bar shows that 7.5 million pounds were collected in 2011, the first full year of the Paint Care program. That's equivalent to a 49% increase, or 2.5 million pounds, of all paint and containers collected. Most of this increase is due to the existence of the Paint Care program. For 2011, you'll see that 14% of the paint collected statewide was managed completely by local waste programs. Another 48% was collected by local waste programs, and the disposition, such as transportation, recycling, and disposal, was managed by Paint Care. Combined, 62% of the paint was collected by local waste programs. 38% of the paint collected in 2011 was collected at retail sites and special Paint Care operated events, and the disposition was also managed by Paint Care. In our report to the 2011 legislature, DEQ recommended making the program permanent and offered recommendations to improve a permanent program. The recommendations included improve convenience to ensure all Oregonians have reasonable access to a collection site, ensure full costs of program activities are covered, including collection costs and DEQ costs. Establish program measures to ensure accountability, including consistent standardized metrics. Amend annual report requirements to enhance transparency. Expand the scope to include aerosol paints. Clarify and strengthen requirements for education and outreach. Make oversight and process changes, including enforcement and more detailed description of program costs. And review the program funding mechanism.
So, if I may, Chair Bailey, I'm going to switch gears here and take up the legislation. As you know, DEQ has pre-session filed House Bill 2048, and you would see if you looked at that bill that DEQ did not pursue all the recommendations that we made in the 2011 report. We chose certain issues and not others, but our overarching goal here was to take what is a pilot project program, which was authorized by very general language, and try to bring to the legislature a very detailed statute, very specific statute about how the program should move forward in the future. And the overall goal was to not only lift the sunset and make the program permanent, but also to make sure that it is a better program. We've had a good start with the program, particularly in the second year of the program, but we think there are critical issues moving forward, and that's what we'll focus on, or I'll focus on in my testimony. One of those critical issues is ensuring that we have convenient collection opportunities for all Oregonians. The current law has a very general standard. It simply requires that there be convenient and available collection in urban and rural areas of the state, and that's just how detailed the statute is. We're proposing that in House Bill 2048 and the amendment that will come along with it, that the language be more detailed and prescriptive about what the convenient standard would be. This is an issue that we're discussing with Paint Care and trying to work on some language with them. But again, the goal would be, the statute would be very clear for the public, for the legislature, for paint care, for DEQ, about where fixed collection sites would be located in Oregon. And again, the goal would also be to ensure that we're serving urban residents and rural residents with convenient collection. A second major issue for this bill is strengthening outreach and education. I think this committee could appreciate that if consumers aren't familiar with the paint care program and they're not made familiar with it, they're not going to really be able to access the program. Convenience is certainly important, but also outreach and education is important to having a successful program. The current language in the existing statute is, again, very general about what's provided in the way of educational materials. With the amendment to House Bill 2048, we're trying to work with paint care on something that is very, again, detailed and prescriptive about the type of activities and the methods they would use to inform the public of the program. And one other thing, or a couple other things I would add, too, we would recommend that the language in the bill include the stewardship organization would be required to provide information to the retailers. So at the time of sale, retailers could provide the consumer with information about the opportunities to collect and recycle paint. We're also, on this issue of education outreach, proposing that the bill now require enforcement language for DEQ, where we could penalize retailers who are not providing this information at time of sale. A third issue here for House Bill 2048 is transparency. The current law is very broad in what it requires of the plan and the annual report. Again, going back to my theme of trying to write a statute that's very specific and detailed, we're talking with paint care to work on language that would be more clear about the program cost and the information around the program cost that's submitted to DEQ. And this is an important point because, as Cheryl mentioned, we have an oversight role around this program. And I might just elaborate a little bit if I can. Basically, as I see it, what we have here is we have an organization which we have given a public license to operate in the state. That license allows them to collect and recycle paint. And the way they do that, the way they finance that program, is with a state statute required fee, a statutorily required fee. Because they are collecting that fee for the purpose of, for really what is essentially a public purpose, collecting and recycling paint, I think it's important that DEQ have an oversight role in making sure that the fee is properly used for the intended purposes. And quite frankly, that's why that whole issue of transparency is important. We need to be able to understand how they're spending the money and what they're spending the money on. And that, again, is an issue that we are working with paint care on to try to come up with joint language on that issue of transparency. A fourth major issue is ensuring that government costs are covered in this program. The pilot project legislation authorized DEQ to collect about $50,000 over a four-year period. Quite frankly, that's not quite enough to manage our actual cost of overseeing the program. So we are proposing an increase to the fees. It would work out under the amendment, if we can get there on the amendment, that it would be around $15,000 for the submittal of a plan. A plan is not required every year. We are talking with paint care about how often a plan would actually need to be submitted. And then the annual cost would be to DEQ would be around $40,000 a year. So in certain years, it could be greater than 40, maybe up to a maximum of 65,000. But for most years, it would be a $40,000 fee for DEQ's oversight. And then the last issue I want to mention is, and I said a bit about it earlier, is the enforcement issue. Again, the current law is very general about the enforcement authority. In fact, it really only authorizes DEQ to use what is pretty much a blunt tool, and that is if someone is not, someone is selling paint in Oregon and they're not participating in the stewardship organization, then DEQ can order them to stop selling paint. That's not any place that we would like to go. We don't want to tell people they can't sell paint in Oregon. So what we are proposing in the amendment to House Bill 2048 is that we would have language that would allow us to assess fees, more typical regulatory fees. And that would give us, we think, greater flexibility to manage any enforcement issues if there were any. So that's a very high level overview of the bill, and Cheryl and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Woodson.
Since we haven't seen the amended bill, in the old bill, in Section 11, it talks about instituting civil penalties up to $200 or $1,000 per day for certain violations. Could you describe what is a $200 violation and what is a $1,000 violation?
Absolutely. Chair Bailey, Representative Woodson, I can certainly do that. The reference there on House Bill 2048 in Section 11 to the $200 a day violation is the issue that I spoke about earlier, where a retailer would not be providing to a consumer information at time of sale. That's the purpose of that penalty. The $1,000 violation, it covers an assortment of issues where the stewardship organization is not operating in compliance with the law.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for all your hard work on this important program. There are some studies that indicate that the cost of recycling paint nationwide appears to be in the neighborhood of $2 a gallon. And I guess I'm concerned, and this is from Cascadia Consulting Group and DSM Environmental. We obtained this information from Product Stewardship Institute, Inc. And the numbers are $2.26 per gallon to $3.22 per gallon. Now, my question is, does this bill give you and your department the ability to determine if that's the cost that the folks in Oregon are paying for this particular service?
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, I'll do my best to answer the question, although I would note I haven't actually seen that study, so I'm not familiar with its findings.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Don't care about the report. Let's just pretend for a moment it's true. Does this piece of legislation we're looking at today give you the authority as a department to determine if the organization that's doing the work is making more or less than the cost, apparently, that this study comes up with? Let's not debate whether or not it's correct. I just want to know if you have the power to determine the number they're charging us.
To answer your question, Representative Benz, the legislation that we're proposing would require the stewardship organization, would require DEQ to approve the funding mechanism. It would also require DEQ to approve the budget. And I say that because the funding mechanism, the added fee to containers is the revenue that comes into the program. We would approve that. And then as a part of the plan submittal for paint care, they submit a budget about how they will spend the dollars. I think because we approve both those things, we have the ability to ensure that the costs are reasonable, that Oregonians aren't paying any more than they should have to for the collection and recycling of paint. The stumbling block, if you will, that we've had, and I think you and I have spoken about this in the past, is understanding the true cost, the true program cost for paint care, and ensuring the DEQ gets that information. And so what we've been talking to paint care about, and they have been very willing to explore this, is to write a statute that's very detailed about the program costs they give us. So when we do our approval of their plan, which again includes the budget, which would include how much are we paying for the cost of paint collection, DEQ will have the information to know whether those are reasonable, appropriate costs for Oregonians.
Hello. So I'm not sure that answers the question, because what I've asked was, will you know the amount per gallon that it's costing, not whether that's reasonable or not. I want to know if you'll know the amount per gallon that this is costing people here in Oregon to have have this paint recycled?
Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is yes. Yes. We know that now, and we want to be sure that we know that in the future.
Okay.
Yes.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
The question is, how much is that per gallon now?
I think, and this was testimony that was provided at the earlier public hearing, is about $6 a gallon, right?
Approximately.
Yeah, approximately.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. The question is, given this, if this number is right, 226 per gallon to 322 per gallon, is costing Oregonians six, is there something that makes it more expensive in Oregon than it would be nationally?
No.
I'm just, we'll assume for a moment that this is correct. And if it is correct, what will the department do about it? If it turns out that there's a $3 difference between the national cost and what it's costing Oregonians.
May I add on to your question,
please.
Representative Benson? And in addition to that, I would say, could you describe how this gets into the issue in the amendments that you're drafting around the information that you're looking to get from Paint Care and their budget? Is part of that to help you understand where these costs come from and to help with contractual procedures in managing these costs, or is that a separate issue?
Maybe I'll take your question first, Representative Bailey, and I want to be sure that we get back to Representative Mintz's question. I don't know if so much the information is about contractual issues or contractual arrangements. It's more about making sure that we have the information to answer two questions. Is the fee appropriate to cover the cost that Paint Care incurs? Of the questions, that's probably the easiest one. The second one, and this goes to Representative Bence's questions, are the costs that Paint Care are incurring for the collection and recycling and ultimate disposal of the paint, are those costs appropriate and reasonable? Do we have a program that is efficient, effective in terms of the coverage it provides and the collections that it seeks to generate? I don't know that, unless Cheryl, you can, I don't know that we can directly answer Representative's question about the difference between what I understand to be national numbers and the Oregon numbers. I think we would have to get back to the committee on that. I do want to assure the committee what we're trying to do is draft a piece of legislation with the assistance of Paint Care that will allow us to ask questions about the cost per container or the per gallon collection costs. And if they seem high to us or don't seem appropriate, that we would have the ability to work with them in making sure that the program is, in fact, cost effective to the consumer.
Please.
And work with them, I don't know quite what that means. If there's a contract with them, what does work with them mean?
Well, if I may, Representative Bailey, Representative Bence, the contracts that are held, and Paint Care may be able to speak to this in greater detail than I can, are between Paint Care and their subcontractors. They have contracts with those who are collecting the paint, those who are transporting it and processing it, as well as contracts with those who are providing the outreach and education that I spoke about. DEQ's arrangement with Paint Care is one where of approval. We approve the fee, we approve the plan. So I may not be answering your question, Representative Bence, but that's how we exercise our oversight. So I guess what I'm saying is, as we get a budget from Paint Care and we understand how they're proposing to spend the revenue that's collected through the per container assessment, we'll need to understand what the costs are per gallon of paint collected and processed, and we'll need to make sure that that's appropriate for Oregon. I'd like to look at the study that you're referring to and make sure that Oregon isn't paying any more than they have to per gallon, but I'm not, quite honestly, I'm not familiar with the study. I haven't had a chance to look at it and try to figure out or ascertain why there is a difference. It would certainly be important if there was a difference for DEQ and our exercise of oversight authority to try to manage through the plan approval process that issue. We don't want to see Oregonians pay any more than they have to. I want the committee to understand that.
As you work out the kinks in the program, what is the rationale for removing the sunset completely versus extending the sunset out for a given period of time?
It's a very good question, Representative Bailey. I think what DEQ is saying is the only set of conditions on which to remove the sunset and make the program permanent are conditions where we strengthen enforcement, where we strengthen the transparency around the program costs that are come to the department from paint care, that we ensure that we've strengthened the outreach and education component so consumers are made more aware of the program, and that we provide a very clear, convenient standard that everybody can understand and that will ensure more collections and more convenience for Argonians. That's what we're saying. Under those set of circumstances, then I think DEQ would recommend to the legislature that the sunset could be lifted. If we can't address those issues, then I think we're going to have to ask a different question.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Does the $6 recycling fee get added on to the price of a gallon of paint then to the consumer?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt. The $6 recycling fee is sort of an average of the cost, the total program cost divided by the number of gallons collected over the year. The assessment for a gallon of paint is 75 cents, and the consumer pays that at the time of sale. When someone drops off the paint, there's no cost.
So I'm trying to understand. So in 2009, you had 5 million pounds of paint. What did that cost then? Is that $30 million to dispose of that paint? Is it 75 cents times 5 million pounds? Is it? I'm trying to understand. There's some disparity in what you're saying it costs to get rid of it and what you're saying is a charge.
Chair. I guess the question perhaps is, where's the missing 525?
Right.
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt. We don't have comprehensive information about the cost to manage all the paint prior to the paint care program. Again, this image shows all the paint collected in the state of Oregon and all the paint containers as well. In 2009, that work was done by all the local governments, and so we don't have the specific information for each of those local governments. The total cost of the paint care program is represented in the second bar for 2011. The upper, let's see, what is that? 76%? And the costs that we're talking about, the paint care program covered that section. So I'm not sure if I'm
there. Yeah, I think I can elaborate a little bit, Representative Whitsitt. First, when you look at the chart here, and it talks about 2009, that was, as we said earlier, that was before the advent of the Paint Product Stewardship Program. The costs of collecting paint at that time were pretty much all borne by local governments. Then in 2010, and it was actually halfway through 2010, in July of 2010, the Paint Care Program was launched. And at that point, the consumer had a second option for the collection and recycling of paint. They could continue to go to their local household hazardous waste facility, which is, again, what was happening in 2009. And then, but now they had a second option, again, midway through 2010, to go to a retail location and take the paint back. In those locations, Paint Care was paying pretty much 100% of the cost. But because people are also accustomed to going to their household hazardous waste facility, there were still traffic, there was still unused paint that was going to household hazardous waste, local household hazardous waste facilities. Paint Care made an arrangement with some of those facilities to pick up the paint and pay the transportation and processing cost. So those two scenarios, through the retail locations and then where Paint Care had an arrangement to go from a local government facility and pay the transportation and processing costs, those two activities are rolled up into a budget of about $3.8 million. That's the revenue that Paint Care collects through the added assessment to containers, and that's what funds their activities. So when you're asking about the 75 cents per gallon assessment, that's what that assessment is actually paying for. I don't know if that answered your question. But
Not entirely.
We'll take the details offline and follow up on it.
All right.
Go to Representative Widener, and then recognize the committee. We have two more bills to get to today and another panel yet on this bill, so we'll try to keep your questions brief and your answers concise, please. Thank you. Representative Widener.
Real quick, you're going through looking at this. Could we get a breakdown of what the fee is for aerosol cans for all the different paint items out there, primer, the whole nine yards, on what it costs the consumer when they purchase the paint? So, because this is something people need to know and we need to understand, because right now we're leaving this open to you to make up the fee to whatever you want. I don't feel comfortable doing that myself. So we need to have something set in stone, because we're walking out of here thinking it's 75 cents. All of a sudden I'm dealing with calls because people in my district are going out and buying paint, and they're $6 more a gallon that they're paying for this paint, and they're going to be a little upset. And that's something that nobody on this panel wants to deal with. And the way this is written now, we're leaving it open for you to make those decisions, and you don't have to answer to anybody but us. And we have to go listen to people for 2 years. So I need a fee structure of everything that's out there. If you could get that to me, I would appreciate it. And then I'll be anxious to see your amendments, because this needs to be tightened up, because it gives you way too much power.
So, Representative, I will certainly give you that breakdown. Did want to make a couple quick comments. Aerosol paints are not included in the program, so just so you know that. And then, generally speaking, it's 35 cents for a quart. It's
aerosol paints are not currently included.
That's right, and we're not proposing that they be.
The amendment will not bring
those
in.
That's right.
Okay, because it's in this one here.
Yes, right.
It's a base bill.
Right.
That's helpful clarification.
And I understand, I understand the difficulty. The community doesn't actually have the amendment, and that's why we tried to provide the handout. But quickly, it's 35 cents for a quart, it's 75 cents for a gallon, and it's $1.60 for a 5 gallon container. But I will make sure I give you a more complete breakdown, but I just wanted to make sure that you knew those two details.
Okay. Let's go to Vice Chair Johnson.
Well, my question was about aerosol cans, which is great. I'm glad to hear you're not broadening the definition of architectural paint. To me, for about paint recovery, it's hard to see how you're going to recover a lot of volume out of an aerosol paint that would justify the expense. But just kind of a comment, I guess, as we talk about penalties and putting the department into an oversight role with the ability to levy penalties and so forth against retailers, I get uncomfortable with that. So to whatever extent you can minimize that in your amendment or whatever, I hope you will. I just am reticent to put the department into another area, potentially the building trades, where I think some of my friends start to get a little discomfort about that issue. So I'm just on the record. Thank you.
Right. If I may, Chair Bailey and Representative Johnson, I hear those concerns a lot. You're probably not surprised by that. But I guess one issue that we were wrestling with, we had heard from a number of stakeholders and from the public that, I think even members of this committee have mentioned it, about going to a paint store and not being provided the information about the options. So we were looking for a way to ensure that that actually happened. And the stewardship organization, Paint Care to the credit, has provided the information to all the retail stores that are participating in the program. They have made that good faith effort, but they simply can't twist the arm of the attendant there in the store or the staff to actually provide something if you or I were to go in. So we were looking to try to deal with that issue, but maybe you and I can talk about that a bit more, and maybe there's a different fee amount or other approaches, but yeah.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Call up Scott Clagg, Steve Dearborn, and Scott Berry, please. Need room for one more?
It'd be great if we did, just for questions.
Is this Rick?
It is, yes.
Okay. Mr. Clagg, why don't you kick us off?
Chair Bailey, my name is Scott Clagg. I'm a senior solid waste planner with Metro, and we're here today to testify in support of House Bill 2048, and we strongly support making the program permanent. I was wondering if I could take the opportunity to answer a couple of the questions that came up just now. I can
please.
First of all, with regard to the question, Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, with regards to your question about the collection of the paint and where's the money going, I think one of the things that the DEQ didn't get the opportunity to say was that there's about 7.5 million gallons of paint on which this fee is assessed every year. So that's the 7.5 million gallons of which get the 75-cent assessment. Now, the amount of paint people use is estimated, you know, nationally and in various states, as about 1 out of every 10 gallons doesn't get used, so that's unused. Last year, the program collected about 600,000 gallons, 609,000 gallons, so that's almost 1 out of 10, it's about 8%, so that's what the fee pays for. So each year, the $4 million or so dollars divided by that 600,000, that's how you get to the $6 a gallon fee. So is that had a little bit of clarity on that? Yeah. So yes, it's because, and I think it was mentioned that previously local areas such as Metro and that had to collect that fee out of their regular rates, and so we've been paying for that cost over the years. The other question, Chair Bailey, Representative Bentz, with regards to, I think I have the same report that you were looking at, and I think that that $2, I believe the number you were quoting was the $2 per gallon on, that was just a collection cost number. So that was different than the recycling number, if I'm looking at the same Cascadia report that you had. And that would be, that would account for, I believe, the difference, because if the 226 to 322 a gallon number.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
In the interest of saving time, the it's not my purpose today to suggest what the number is to figure out if this report gives our department the power to see if the amount being charged is right, wrong, or where it is.
All right.
So, so what those costs may be, I really couldn't say.
Okay. Well, Metro had an involved, Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, thank you. So I'll return to my testimony at this point.
Please, and if you could keep it brief, that
sure,
would be great.
I will.
Thank you.
So as I said, Metro has had a household hazardous waste program since 1986, and paint is the largest single amount of material we collect. We get about 4 million pounds of household hazardous waste a year. We collect of the 609,000 pounds, gallons of paint that were collected in the state. About half of that's coming from the metro region. Our program has been recycling paint since 1992. We've now got a Green Seal product. We sell in over 50 stores and around the state and the region. With the advent of the program, we've benefited significantly in several ways. One is that Paint Care now pays us the cost to manage the paint that previously we managed and recycled on our own. So the benefit to us is on the order of $1 million a year in resources and that can now be used for other parts of our programs. In terms of convenience, we now have 16 additional collection sites in the metro region that collect paint for our residents because of this program. We've improved the ability to recycle our paint. The larger amount of paint, we're now taking in paint from elsewhere in the state to help recycle. That's increased our ability to offer different kinds of paint colors, as well as our marginal costs have gone down. Our unit price on recycling has fallen. And I would not want to mention the environmental benefits from recycling paint, because recycling is better than just disposing. In the past 4 years, Metro's participated in the DEQ stakeholder process. We submitted comments on the bill much in align with the DEQ recommendations. We're pleased that the bill 2048 addresses the most important of those in terms of setting goals, convenience, improving education, and reporting. So we're very happy to be here today to support making this program permanent.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Berry, I note that the American Coatings Association, we had Allison Keene and Mr. Vopel testifying last time. Do you have new information to add for this committee in your testimony?
Chair Bailey, just a very little bit, and I'll make my comments extremely brief.
Thank you.
Scott Berry on behalf of the American Coatings Association. I just wanted to give you a quick progress report. As many of you heard Palmer Mason talk about the progress that we are making with DEQ in terms of kind of quantifying and clarifying and getting down to brass tacks on the amendments. Yearly reporting, I think we got very close on that. As of yesterday, we met with them in the afternoon and made some, I think, real progress. Transparency, administrative costs for 2012 were down to 6%. So I think that's something worth mentioning. It was not mentioned before. Also, all residents in Oregon under the standard, which you have in your tax information that we gave you last time, all residents covered within that 15-mile radius, up to 94.4% of all Oregon residents, still recognizing that rural areas are probably the spots we need to focus on with DEQ in terms of the standard. And with that, I'll introduce, if I can, Steve Dearborn, who's with us today from Miller Paint.
Thank you. Mr. Dearborn.
Representative Bailey, members of the committee, I'm, for the record, my name is Steve Dearborn. I'm president and CEO of Miller Paint. Miller Paint has been manufacturing and selling quality paint in the state of Oregon and Portland since 1890. We've got 49 stores, 26 of which are in the state of Oregon, and 14 of those 26 are retail, volunteer retail collection sites for which we take paint back every day in our stores for no fee. So that's a free part of the program. I am also, truth be told, a member of the board of American Coatings Association. I work closely with Allison. I'm an original member of the board of Paint Care. I was involved in setting the fees, setting the initial fees of 75 cents, 35 cents for a quart, and $1.60 for fives. And I'm here as an enthusiastic supporter of making House Bill 2048 permanent. I'm proud of my industry. I'm proud of the fact that we've taken charge of our own waste stream, if you will. It's the right thing to do to recycle paint instead of having it in the landfill. Our experience thus far, 4 years into the program, as both a manufacturer and a retailer and a seller of the recycled paint, we go full circle, is that it's been very smooth. The operation startup was smooth. The operation in the store at the counter has been very smooth. There's been a minimum of oversight required. From a retailer's perspective, it's a positive thing because we have people coming into our store today bringing back unused paint that we didn't have yesterday. So from a retailing perspective, it's been a positive thing also. Our customers get it. And one of the initial hurdles that we had to get over was explaining this fee that they had on the bottom of their invoice and what it meant, who was behind it, why are you doing this, and everything else. And when we explained to them, number one, that Paint Care is a nonprofit organization, we set the fees so that the expenses and the fees are equal, so nobody's profiting from this fee you see on the bottom, that we're recycling the paint, it's not going into the landfill. They can see if they happen to be in a store that they're a retail collection site, they can see that they can bring their paint back. We try at every opportunity to explain to them, whether it's a brochure at the counter or the poster on the window, what Paint Care is and why it's a good thing for our state and for our environment. So our customers get it, our store managers get it. There is no special handling required in the stores. Our customers like the convenience. They have accepted the fee because it is the right thing to do. The only thing that my only concern at this point is we've been 4 years in this program. The most recent year we set the fees, have been the same for 4 years. And we've got customers, some of which are in the building trade, many of which are in the building trade, who are looking for a fee reduction. They know that we've got a surplus in this year. We collected $4.2 million. It cost $3.8 million to run the program. They're looking for a reduction in that fee. And we've told them, and this is a credibility issue, this is a nonprofit function here. We're going to set the fee equivalent, you know, we're going to set the fee equivalent to what the costs are to recycle the program. So there's an issue there that I think we need to address. But other than that, I think the program has run very smoothly.
Thank you. And Mr. Dearborn, when did Miller Paint stores start taking back paint, out of curiosity?
We were one of the first. Our 14 stores were in the initial, I think at that point we had 60 or 70 locations. Today there are 100, I mean, total retail collection sites. But we volunteered, of our 26 stores, we volunteered 20 of them. 14 were selected as retail collection sites. And this is from Albany up through Portland.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Chair. I think this question is for Mr. Dearborn. So I'm really grateful that you started this program, and we thank you for that. I've been a Miller Paint customer since about 1974.
We thank you for that.
Okay. The question is, are we getting as much back as we can? And, you know, what's the potential return? And would incentives of some kind help with that regard? Had you thought about incenting customers? So,
you know, that's a very good question, Representative Reardon. And when we first put paint care together, our model was actually Canada. And there are models that show, there's history that shows that the increase in the amount of recycled paint that comes back over time, we're at the front end of that curve. I believe that we can that we can do better. I think there's more paint to come back, obviously. Better communication, not just at the store, because at the store, when you're paying the fee, is an opportunity for us to talk about paint care, but that isn't the first thing that's obviously on the consumer's mind, is where am I going to bring back my unused paint. But I think there could be a better job in communicating, advertising, that you know, these retail collection sites are available. And it will grow. The stream will grow over time.
Thank you very much. Very briefly, Representative Widener, we got to get on to our next bill.
Real quick, Mr. Dearborn, because you're on the front lines. I mean, you kind of heard the concern here is the cost of what this fee might be to the consumer. And I don't know if you've had a chance to go through what's been presented in front of us, but it puts a lot of power in DEQ's hand to regulate and very little power in anybody else's hands. So if you get a chance to go through the bill, I think it'd be wise to do, and then give us your feedback after looking at it. Because if it's just 75 cents per gallon, I think most of us could probably get on board with that. But if we're having to see this jump up to $3 or $6 a gallon, I think it hurts your industry.
I'd certainly like to comment on that. We, I mean, on an average basis today, it's 54 cents. When you take the three sizes, 75 cents a gallon, 35 cents a quart, $1.60 a five, that's what our customers are seeing on the bill. I anticipate, and the ACA and Paint Care fully anticipate, that rate is going to continue to go down. It's not going to go up to $2 or $3 a gallon unless we find other ways to spend the money, which we're not going to. I mean, our commitment from the beginning has been we're going to set the rates equivalent to the cost of the program. And as we drive the program costs down, I mean, with due respect to the DEQ, they're not responsible for setting the rates. They're responsible for receiving the report and reviewing, but it's Paint Care that sets the rates. It's Paint Care that has the contracts with the haulers, with the Metro paints that are recycling the paint, with the administrative costs, and those costs are not going to go up. They're only going to go down. The $3.8 million versus the 4.2, I would anticipate right now that 54 cents should come down 10% anyway, going into making this bill permanent.
I would look for ways to keep DEQ out of it if it's me, but.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Okay, having exhausted our sign-up list for House Bill 2048, do we have one more person who wants to testify on House Bill 2048? Sir, please keep your comments very brief. Thank you.
Understood. Chairman Bailey, my name is Bob Fankhauser, for the record.
You might pull one of those microphones towards you just a little bit there.
I've been to a number of the stakeholder meetings at DEQ. I found that I'm the only taxpayer representative. Everybody else there is either industry or DEQ. When I first found out about this program, I said, oh, great. Then I said, wait a minute, where's the outreach? Because there's very little. And then finally I said, as I've noted in the submission, latex paint, which is the majority of the issue, isn't a problem. We buy it, we spread it all over our houses, in our children's bedrooms. The paint that is rejected by the plant down on Swan Island is trucked to Arlington and pumped into the landfill as a biodegradation enhancer. So I see Oregonians as paying $4.5 million a year for a problem that really doesn't exist. And that $4.5 million could be put to a lot better use. I'm all in favor of recycling, but it has to make economic and environmental sense. And I don't think this program does. So I recommend sunsetting it. That said, if it's not sunsetted, I do agree with the recommendations of 2048. everything that I've seen in my attendance at the stakeholder meetings has been very fuzzy, quite opaque. Paint care has, in my opinion, not been forthcoming as to costs and that sort of thing. They have not done a good job of outreach, and so I think there are some real problems. I think 2048 would help address those problems. At the very least, I would recommend continuing the sunset provision, and I would take any questions. My contact information is on my submission. Anybody who would like to talk to me, please do so.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2048, open a public hearing on House Bill 2813, and call up Billy Don Robinson and Susan Aldrich Markham. While they're coming up, Adam, you want to tell us about the bill?
House Bill 2813 declares Arundodonax L, known as giant cane or giant reed, a noxious weed and invasive species meriting eradication. It prohibits commercial or horticultural growing or harvesting of Arundodonax L. It requires the Oregon Department of Agriculture to adopt rules enforcing a prohibition on growing or harvesting Arundodonax L.
Thank you. And we're going to ask you both to keep your testimony to 3 minutes. That would be great.
3 minutes it is.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for your this opportunity to testify. I will forego introducing members of our delegation. We have a lot of PhDs, professors, emerita, and Susan, could you introduce yourself?
My name is Susan Aldrich Markham, and I am a retired extension agent from Oregon State University Agricultural Extension Agent. I guess I can say more when I get...
And Professor Emerita, OHSU. My name is Billy Don Robinson. I am Vice President for the Native Plant Society of Oregon. I chair the Legislative Committee. You have my testimony. I don't want to take too much time because I have some visuals that I'd like to share. Our key points, you know, of course, I'm speaking in support of House Bill 2813. The key points, Arundodonax is a catastrophic invasive species in other areas. Arundodonax is likely to become a catastrophic invasive species in Oregon. ODA's risk assessment understates the risk of Arundodonax for at least 5 different reasons. Arundodonax should be classified as a noxious weed and listed. Essentially, we have a larger issue here. The permanent rule that we have now permits the commercial planting of Arundodonax, whether PGE does it or not. Okay, there's a new cellulosic ethanol plant that's just been opened in Boardman. In North Carolina, an Italian company, Chemtrex, is planning on using 100,000 tons per year for cellulosic ethanol. Under the current rule, whether PGE plants or doesn't, others can grow this extensively. If it's grown on a commercial level, it will escape. That is inevitable. And here's our visuals. Take a look. In California, all right, it's significant that this is under a bridge. This plant grows so thickly that it changes the hydrology of rivers. It takes bridges out. Water can't pass. Here's what it looks like. The old canes, you see, they're layering over. All right, the first year canes are standing up. Those are just the first year. You see the equipment there cutting them down. All right, that's what it's going to look like in the estuaries all along the Columbia River. Okay, every last one of them. And that's kind of taken from looking down from a bridge. You know, you see the layering. You see how it's crowding out all other species. Take a look at that. Okay, they've removed it from native trees. Look how big that is. So it grows 10 inches a year, 30 feet tall. Again, 1 2-inch piece of the rootstock breaks off this stuff, game over. This is what it's going to look like in every estuary along the Columbia River without fail. And just one last thing, that's how thick it grows. You see dead secondary branches, you see leaf litter. Where this stuff invades, and it has moved all the way from Southern California, all the way up the coast. We now have a feral population in Talent, Oregon right now. That's what it looks like. Okay, that's just a first year stand. Nobody knows where it came from. Okay? So, at any rate, House Bill 2813 is the only way the potential invasion of Arundo Donax can be prevented. Otherwise, ODA's permanent rule will allow any and all widespread commercial plantings of this catastrophic invasive species. And let me tell you, when we're talking about jobs, when this stuff escapes, it's going to be a job killer in eastern Oregon. All right, I'm talking about sport fishing. I'm talking about river rafting, the mom and pop bait shop, the gas station, that nice little bed and breakfast along the trout stream. Forget it. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for your time.
Thank you, and we appreciate your testimony, and thank you for keeping it concise. We appreciate it.
Absolutely welcome, Chair.
Ms. Aldridge Markham, please.
Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the opportunity. I am, as I mentioned, a retired extension agent. I have worked in agriculture for 25 years in several regions in Oregon, the Willamette Valley, Central Oregon, the coast, and Southern Oregon. My particular area of expertise is weed control, both in commercial crops and in invasive species and non-crop area. Field crops was my area as an extension agent. I would like to address Arundo Donax from the point of view of weed control. If Arundo Donax is grown in Oregon, it is absolutely inevitable that it will eventually escape from cultivation and become the same environmental disaster here that it has become in California and other states. The reason I am certain this will happen is because weed control is never 100%. A control of a weed species by a herbicide is considered excellent when 95 to 99% of the plants are killed. In most situations, this is good enough. But in the case of a weed species as invasive as Arundo Donax, it is not good enough. This creeping perennial plant reproduces readily from its rootstocks or rhizomes, and a single piece is enough to start a fast-growing infestation outside of a production field. The more acres of Arundo Donax that are planted, the more inevitable this escape becomes, and the faster the invasion of non-crop land will be. When a farmer takes a field out of production, the surviving rhizomes will regrow as weeds in the subsequent crop, often for years. This happens with weeds that are not as invasive as Arundo Donax. It's certain to happen with this one. During the time that the Arundo Donax is in the field, it is capable of being moved out on agricultural equipment with moving water, and also it is able to grow out beyond the boundaries of the field into the neighboring field. Pieces of rhizome are likely to be stuck in the mud on agricultural equipment and then dropped along roadsides or accidentally planted in other fields. The Oregon Department of Agriculture rules on the control area for growing Arundo that are current in the current control area requires that equipment be cleaned up free of soil and plant disease debris before being moved out of a production field. But equipment in an agricultural field cannot be cleaned perfectly. There is no provision for inspecting the equipment There was no fine or other deterrent to keep this rule from being ignored. And with many farmers on a large scale, many pieces of equipment, there is no possible way to keep all the rhizomes contained.
If you could wrap up your testimony, that'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. I have some other ways that I wanted to mention that the rhizomes can be moved out of a field with normal agricultural practices where nothing unusual or extraordinarily bad happens, but the weed will spread because they always do. From an energy point of view, looking for the largest possible amount of biomass for a system, you would choose the fastest growing plant on the planet, which this probably is. From an environmental point of view, you would be out of your mind to choose this plant and plant it in Oregon on a large scale because it will certainly become invasive. You could rationalize by saying no one knows yet how well it will grow in the Columbia Basin. Perhaps the climate is too cold and it won't persist. But if that is the case, why bother growing it on a small scale for a test? Obviously, PG&E thinks that it will grow well here, as I do. So I don't see a reason for planting it either on a small scale or a large scale. On a small scale, if you don't think it will become invasive, there's no use wasting your money. On a large scale, it will become invasive.
Great. And if you could conclude your testimony, that would be great. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Got it. Representative Widener.
Real quick, did you mean Pacific Gas and Electric or Portland General Electric?
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, Portland General Electric.
Portland General Electric.
Okay,
did I say that?
You said PG&E, which is Pacific Gas in
okay.
California.
I wanted to mention the procedure, the difficulty for controlling this plant. The herbicide glyphosate will, or Roundup is a trade name, will control the plant, but it involves spraying it, coming in with flail mower or chainsaw afterwards to cut it all down. It will resprout because you're going to get 95% control. You have to spray it again. You have to keep monitoring the area for several years. There are places like on a steep riverbank or...
And I will note that we do have your testimony here, so we have all of that information here at the dais with us. We'll make sure to read it carefully. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bailey. Thank you, members of the committee.
Additional questions? Great. Thank you very much for making the trip. We appreciate it, and thank you for your testimony.
You're very welcome, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. Thank you.
Call up Brenda McCarthy.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy representing Portland General Electric today. As always represent PG. As I've said before many times, we're the largest investor-owned electric utility in the state. We serve 825,000 customers in the Northern Willamette Valley, 4,000 square mile service territory, and we own and operate about 2,200 megawatts of our own generation, and we have an average daily load of somewhere north of 2,600 megawatts. Why is that important? Well, that's important because we're on the road to shutting down one of our key baseload resources in our Boardman power plant. It's a 585 megawatt coal-fired facility. Pursuant to a judicial settlement and pursuant to administrative regulation, we will cease burning coal in that facility by the end of 2020. In the intervening time, we're installing pollution controls to deal with emissions from that plant, but barring a conversion of that facility to a biomass facility, it will cease being an energy producing facility. It's an opposite wall fired pulverized coal plant. It cannot be converted to a natural gas facility, and strangely, it's a relatively new coal facility. It was built in 1980, but it wasn't operated very much due to oversupply in the 80s. But when Trojan nuclear facility was shut down, Boardman became a workhorse in our generation fleet. It doesn't have a lot of years on it, and if we can find a solution that enables us to reuse that facility, we think it's worth pursuing. Additionally, when we were engaged in the shutdown discussions with the environmental community, we pledged that we would pursue options to replace that Boardman facility with renewable power of some kind. As you're well aware, the Renewable Portfolio Standard categorizes biomass as a renewable energy source. So we believe that a possible conversion to renewables is a good thing. It meets our renewable standard. It accomplishes the objectives of ceasing coal-fired generation and reuses in a sustainable manner a facility with a lot of life left in it. It's important to note the difference between most renewables out there. There are variable resources and baseload resources. I'm sure many of you are aware. Most of the utility-scale resources available in the renewable world are variable. Wind generation produces energy when the wind blows. We are about 11% renewable at PGE right now. That's almost predominantly wind generation. There's a little slice of solar, and there are some other little pieces and parts that fill that gap, but it's mostly wind. When we think about meeting our 25% renewable standard in 2025, meeting that with all wind poses some significant challenges to the utility as currently structured. If we can think about a large-scale baseload energy resource that's also renewable, that is a pretty good thing to think about and really helps us meet that standard.
And you can wrap up your comments.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, we're here today because obviously one of the plants that we're looking at is Arundo Donax to torrefy and turn into essentially biocoal. We're looking at 18 other substances, but as the previous testimony indicated, we're looking at Arundo because of its production. We are also testing a high-yield sorghum, which has the potential for producing somewhere in the 16 to 20 ton per acre range. We hope that that's successful. But we've got to solve, for biomass, we have to solve the transportation issue, which makes the economics of biomass work. We can't transport the substance from too far away. The other sources available in the state, generally speaking, are not reliable enough and don't exist in large enough quantities to fuel the plant burning 300 tons of coal per hour. So Arundo is an attractive option in that sense. Now, we've been growing it for 2 years. We're growing it on 90 acres. So far, our research, very transparent, bringing in OSU Extension, bringing in the major universities in the Northwest, bringing in the Electric Power Research Institute, bringing in the Department of Agriculture, our research thus far has not shown any invasive tendencies. And we'll continue to be as transparent as possible in our growing of it. We're pushing for a test burn in 2014. This will form a portion of that fuel supply in 2014. We believe we need to finish this R&D effort on Arundo and find out whether it works chemically in the plant, whether it's an option for the future. It may or may not be. It may not work. But we're going to pursue it until we figure out whether it does or not. So based on what we've learned so far and the controls we have in place, the Department of Ag and our own growing conditions established with Morrow County, we don't believe this bill is currently necessary.
Thank you very much. Questions Thanks. For this witness? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just an observation. If the material could be genetically marked, that which you're growing on that 90 acres, so that should it escape, it could be traced back to your company, would you guys then hold the state harmless from the cleanup costs?
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, that's a question of first impression for me. We have eradication bonds in place with Morrow County of $1 million. At the, to the extent that we believe that's probably sufficient to take care of any eradication from our growing. I don't know the answer to your specific question. I'm not a plant biologist. I don't know if it could be genetically marked.
I just ask that you assume it. If we can do that, and then if the company can appropriately ensure its eradication, that would be something we'd be interested in hearing about. I would be, anyway.
Representative Denborough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you to PGE for pursuing this, this route of alternative, biomass. And, I certainly understand the attraction of Arundo Donax. As the person testifying before said, if one's only looking at, what's going to grow the most and be the most productive, but the question of whether or not there's a downside to that environmentally. The test stand that's in place now is going to be used for that 2014 burn, right? And then, let's say, assuming that that test goes in a positive manner, then that, was it 90 acre or?
It's 90 acres.
Yeah, the 90 acre stand would then presumably be taken to scale, right? So is there a concern that, what might work and be able to be contained within the 90 acres, relatively small, once it's taken to scale, then we're potentially in trouble. So what will be the sort of, the test indicators for that?
Right. Chair Bailey, Representative Denborough. I think the important thing is that this biomass option has to work economically. That's fundamentally the key here. It has to compete with a wind resource backed up by a natural gas resource. Fundamentally, that means producing a consistent fuel supply that we can operate the plant 6 months out of the year during our peak seasons and meet essentially the same cost for that wind gas resource. That means that you've got to produce enough on an acreage, per acre that it works, that you can give a farmer a fuel supply contract long term that will meet their needs and meet yours economically. We have assumed in our planning that the Arundo would be grown in rotation with high value crops in the area. One of the things that we are finding out is that the production of Arundo in the first few years has not been nearly as robust as we had hoped. We were hoping for 25 to 30 dry tons per acre, and we haven't seen that yet. Now, that's not to say that we're not getting growth that we think is promising, but this is an R&D effort, and we're learning these things as we go along. There may be other solutions. Again, this high-yield sorghum that we're testing may be one of those. Obviously, I think factoring the risks of spread into the actual production would be something that we would be looking at. Again, though, we are testing virtually everything we can think about in terms of potential spread. We have taken nodes and put them in a greenhouse condition at Herrick and attempted to sprout them. We were unsuccessful. We've laid canes down on field edge and watered them with the irrigation. They did not sprout. The current harvest methods that we are developing involve running them through a corn chopper and laying them in windrows in the field until they dry. We believe that that is critical to ensuring that the accidental spread does not happen. These are things that we're looking at very carefully. Your main point, though, is the one that we need to be concerned about. As we scale up, the risks of unintentional spread could grow, and that's something we need to be mindful of. But at this point in time, it's far too early to determine whether this is the plant yet or not.
Thank you. Sir.
Burning questions? We need to move on. Okay. Thank you. Close public hearing on House Bill 2813, and we're going to open a work session on
House Bill 2105. Adam, will you explain the Dash 2 amendments, please?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendments replace the measure. It requires the Oregon Department of Energy, or ODO, to study and report on issues relating to the Energy Facility Siting Council, or EFSEC, by November 1st, 2013. It requires the report to include issues relating to consistency of energy siting requirements put forward by federal and local governments, means to encourage greater participation by local governments, state agencies, and federally recognized tribes in design and siting of energy facilities, and clarification of definition of energy facilities for the purposes of determining which public body has authority related to siting. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. It has no revenue impact, though it does have a fiscal impact, which is attached. It did have a subsequent referral to a House Committee on Land Use that has been rescinded.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 13, 2013.
Vice Chair Johnson moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 13, 2013. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2105 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves House Bill 2105 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. And that will go to the floor. Volunteers on the carrier? Representative Bentz?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
I'll have Representative Bentz carry. Thank you, Representative. Closed work session on House Bill 2105. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3251. And call up Michael Burdick, Tom Wolf, and Heather Curtis, I believe. And while they're coming up, Adam, will you tell us about the bill?
So, Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 3251 prohibits operation of motor vehicles weighing more than 200 pounds in beds or banks of any waterway in the Common School Forest Lands or Elliott State Forest Lands. This excludes boats, vehicles owned by a state or local government, vehicles engaged in emergency rescue, vehicles crossing from road surface on one side of a bank to a road surface on the other side of the bank, or vehicles engaged in activities specified by rule by the Department of State Lands. It makes the violation a Class A violation with a maximum a fine of $2,000.
Thank you. And gentlemen, I apologize. Our first bill took about twice as long as was anticipated, and we're going to have to ask you, like the previous bill, to keep your comments to about 3 minutes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Michael Burdick, Office of State Treasurer. Thanks for hearing the bill today. This obviously, as the committee administrator just said, seeks to ban the use of motorized vehicles in the streams of the Elliott State Forest. At a meeting of the land board last year, it came to the attention of the treasurer that this is not illegal, despite the fact that it is detrimental to the forest. The Elliott State Forest is an asset of the Common School Fund, production from the forest provides ongoing revenue to the K-12 school system in Oregon. The land board is bound by Article 8, Section 5 of the Oregon Constitution to manage lands under its jurisdiction with the object of obtaining the greatest benefit for the people of this state, consistent with the conservation of this resource under sound techniques of land management. And it's out of the desire to preserve the forest and obtain the greatest benefit from it that the treasurer asks for your support for House Bill 3251. Obviously, income from the state forest comes from the growth of timber, and healthy streams of rivers play a critical role in the forest productivity. Nutrient distribution water systems usually flows downriver, but the activities of salmon, steelhead, and other fish species migrating from the ocean bring important nutrients up from the ocean that would otherwise not be present in the soil. Studies show that nitrogen availability is a significant limiting factor for plant growth in northern temperate forests. And I have some research cited in my submission to you that I'll be skipping over a little bit of for time. Nitrogen, phosphorus, these minerals would not exist in the soil if not for the action of the fish. The U.S. Geological Survey found in 2007 that the effects of off-highway vehicle activities on water quality include sedimentation, turbidity, and pollutants. And sedimentation increases because compacted soils, disrupted soil crusts, and reduced vegetation can lead to increased runoff. Pollution associated with
off-highway vehicle emissions and spills of petroleum products may be absorbed by to sediments and absorbed into plant material or into dissolved into runoff. Increased sedimentation and turbidity in waterways are known to have a profound effect on the health of salmon and other fish living there. And basically, because of the adverse effects of driving in the streams, and in turn the adverse effects on the fish and therefore the productivity of the forest, the Treasurer believes that this practice is not consistent with sound management of the forest, and therefore the activity should be prohibited. So we ask for your aye vote on the bill. And I should just bring your attention to a couple of items that we are expecting to amend. They're very small changes, but we wanted to, there's some exceptions that allow for rescue and emergency operations. We wanted to add recovery because technically the emergency is over and the person's rescued, but you might still need to recover items such as a crashed plane or anything that might need to be recovered ought to be legally able to be recovered. Also, stream connections in connection with activities that are directed by the Department of State Lands, we attempted to allow for that, but it came to our attention that there were that needs to be expanded slightly.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I think you'll find a pretty interesting panel and diverse support for a bill like this.
You're frequently sitting next to Mr. Wolf in agreement.
Indeed,
right?
Indeed. I would say Oregon Forest Industry Council is in support of this bill. Our members manage approximately 5 million acres in the state, in the forest sector, employs about 75,000 people. We spend a lot of time and money trying to help streams in the state, and in support of the governor's salmon plan, we've spent a lot of time actually putting structure in streams over the last 15 years, including millions of dollars in those efforts. That's one of the biggest deficiencies in Oregon's waterways, is the lack of structure for solid fish habitat. And so from our perspective, putting vehicles in the stream, and particularly recreational vehicles, threatens to undo a lot of what we've tried to help there. And so in that light, I think the bill is a good idea. Keeping vehicles out of the stream is something that OFIC would support. That said, as the previous speaker mentioned, Class 2 vehicles is defined really very broadly, and that would include any vehicle that's larger than a Class 1 vehicle, any vehicle bigger than an ATV, basically, that goes off-highway. There are certain circumstances when, for instance, you're building a road, where for very limited duration of time you would have to enter the stream, and the Forest Practices Act regulates that very strictly. And so from our perspective, it may be that if in fact the state is conducting a forest operation on state property, that they may want to authorize temporary stream crossings in those circumstances under the, you know, explicit regulation of the Forest Practices Act. And I think that we're in productive conversations to that end. But generally speaking, it's worth noting that OFIC works hard to promote stream health, and we actually spend a lot of money on this, and we think that putting rigs in the creek is actually a bad idea. So we're here to urge your support of House Bill 3152.
Thank you. Mr. Wolf.
Chair Bailey, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, and before I start testifying, I just want to take a few moments to savor the fact that I'm on the same side with OFIC. Okay, I'm done. But but anyway, we support House Bill 3251. I agree with my colleague that it's bad. One of the things outside of reality shows, the thing I hate most on TV is ads that show cars racing through streams. And I've written many letters to Toyota and Datsun, I mean, and Nissan and Ford and many others over the years protesting those ads, which hasn't done any good because they still run them. But I think that this bill would accomplish on the school fund lands the ability to stop large vehicles like this from being in streams, because as it was stated before, there's many studies out there that show that if you allow big vehicles in streams on a regular basis, they destroy habitat that's crucial. And one of the crucial habitats for fish in these streams, especially for coastal coho, is large woody debris, which protects the young smolts as they're rearing and growing. And it, without large woody debris in those streams, winter storm events sweep them down and they expire. So it's very important to keep that large woody debris in there. Therefore, it's very important, this bill is important, to keep cars out of the vehicles to protect these streams so that we can continue to recover the wild fish in our streams. So we urge you to pass this bill out of committee with a due pass recommendation, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? By the way, I might note that I don't think the phrase "rigs in the creek" has ever been uttered in my district, but perhaps. Representative Boone.
Okay. I may be old, but I remembered this. 1997, there was a bill, and Tommy might have been involved with this. It's 3716, House Bill 3716. At my request to Representative Josie at the time, and it basically, you know, what had happened is the problem was there was a logger who ran through a fish-bearing stream with the cat back and forth to do something, whatever. Anyway, it turned out it's a civil penalty. I think we addressed this in that law. This is, we didn't talk about ATVs or things like that, but that was, you know, doing something like that intentionally, knowing that it was a fish-bearing stream. It wasn't, it had nothing to do with that large woody debris or anything like that, but I just wanted to say I think it might already be in the law. I mean, this is. And I don't have the ORS citation on it. I just looked it up really quick.
We can certainly look into that. Okay. Thank you, Representative. Representative Whitsitt?
I have a two-part question. How many acres are in the common school forest lands?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, I think I can answer that. The State Land Board owns 91% of the Elliott State Forest, which is 93,000 acres. That's all I can give you at the moment, but I can look up the answer to your question.
Okay, and how many deer and elk that weigh over 200 pounds do you think access the streams of the common school forest lands?
I'll take that as a rhetorical question, Representative.
Yeah, I would just like to follow up, and I'd like to have somebody provide me with the scientific evidence that permanent environmental damage has been done by either these elk, these deer, or anything that weighs over 200 pounds across this stream. I'd appreciate a list of that, if you could, please. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, if I could just mention that the intention of this bill is not to protect the environment, but to protect the productivity of the forest.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does seem to me like there are two questions here. On one hand, Mr. Burdick's talking about productivity, to getting the most bang for the buck, if you will, out of our state, out of this portion of forest land. On the other hand, we've got the environmental interest talking about fish. Those are two different interests, and I'm not saying they're mutually exclusive. I'm just saying there are two different interests here, so I'm not sure exactly what the purpose behind the bill is, but I'll get into a question. Are we asking here for regulations that are over and above what we require currently in other state forest lands, or is this just going to put Elliott in compliance with other state forest lands?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I believe we have a representative of the state forester here.
Sir, would you like to come forward,
answer
please?
That?
And if you identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, I'm Mike Bordelon. I'm the division chief for State Forest. So State Forest manages common school forest lands. We also manage Board of Forestry land. Mm-hmm. So the common school forest land portion is 120,000 acres, and the Board of Forestry portion is about 700,000 acres. On Board of Forestry lands, we currently have, through our recreation rules, a prohibition on vehicles going off of designated trails or roads. Right? So this bill would sort of bring into alignment the common school portion.
Follow up, please.
just simply going off of a trail or a road is different than driving into a stream bank, though.
Right.
Or would this be more restrictive, or is that currently, I mean, you see what I'm saying? Somebody could be driving on dry land but not in a roadbed. Would that be allowed in Elliott Forest, or not in a stream bed? Would that be allowed in the bill?
So, Chair Bailey, Representative Johnson, under the recreation rules on our Board of Forestry land, these are the lands in Northwest Oregon principally. I think the terminology we use, and I have it here, might be helpful. We basically prohibit motor vehicles from driving off of designated roads or trails.
Okay.
So in that context, to my knowledge, there are no stream systems that are designated roads or trails, right? And basically this recreation rule was set up to not only protect stream systems, but to protect upland areas from in a recreation context, and to protect road systems as well. So again, from the context of recreation management, I think that's...
So, 3251 purely has in view traffic around water and streams and so forth. Doesn't talk about those upland uses at all, so you're not asking for that additional right here. Okay, one follow-up question.
Please.
Mr. Burdick, you talk about the highest economic value. I totally get you on that. Can you talk about what degree or what percentage of the sustainable yield is harvested each year right now on the Elliott State Forests? How much of what grows every year do we actually harvest? If we're, in fact, using this to its maximum ability to put money into the fund for kids in schools?
You know, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we're currently in litigation over that issue, and I don't believe I should speak about it.
Okay.
Fair point.
Thank you.
Final question, Representative Bentz?
Yes.
Other witnesses, but thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, in beds or banks is the language. In the beds or banks, can you define that? Tell us what that means.
Yeah.
I'm not an author of this bill. I think what's intended here, and I think going back to some of the discussion at State Land Board when this issue came up, I think the interest here is to try to keep vehicles out of stream systems, right, which includes the in the water, in the stream bank, in the stream bed of a given stream. So in order to get there, you're going to have to drive through the banks of that stream.
Yep.
I think that's the intent.
Okay, the follow-up is, this doesn't mean driving alongside it. It means down in it.
I believe that's the intent here in the context of the original issue when it came up. There were clearly evidence that folks were driving right in the stream systems.
Yeah, if I may. Okay, it means in. I just want the record to be clear. It doesn't mean up alongside it on top of the bank. It means down in it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I represent events. We actually do have the lawyer for the Department of State Lands in the audience, I believe, who would be able to speak to the exact meaning of the bank.
Only if you want to take that time, Mr. Chair.
I think it would be useful to hear that. Why don't you come forward, sir?
For the record, my name is Mark Schumach. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice. Chair Bailey, the question really was, what is the bed and bank of a waterway? And I think from a legal perspective, the bed is the bottom of the water, the river where the water is actually located. The banks would be anything below ordinary high water on either side. So every waterway has both a high water and a low water that obviously changes during the season. So at high water, you have a bank that's created by the movement of the water. Basically, it's the line, anything below the line of vegetation. I think that's the intent of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dembro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the representative of the Forestry Department. So it sounds to me as if the Elliott Forest is under a less restrictive set of guidelines with respect to motorized vehicles than the Department of State lands. Well, why is that?
Yeah. Chair Bailey, Representative Dembro, I think there's some history here in terms of recreation use on state forest land and on common school forest lands, which is principally the Elliott State Forest. Recreation is viewed as a passive use. The main objectives on common school forest lands are to maximize revenues over the long term. That's the objective. So clearly recreation is allowed, but it's not really a managed recreation program. And on Board of Forestry lands in the northwest part of the state, we have an active, it's part of our statutory mandate is to provide recreation opportunities. We have a more managed recreation program. And in that context, we developed some rules of engagement around recreation management on those Board of Forestry lands in northwest. And in the context of the Elliott, they haven't at this point got to that level of use or level of recreation. We have a very significant off-highway vehicle program in the Tillamook State Forest, for example, and again, which requires some level of management, therefore set of rules around that management. The other thing I would mention is the Elliott State Forest is not the only common school forest lands. We have some intermixed common school forest lands in northwest Oregon as well. So again, this bill would allow some level of commonality here around standards for those intermixed lands as well.
Just if I can follow up, from the department's perspective, would it not be preferable to have consistency between the two types of forests?
And from the standpoint of managing those forest lands, it's and managing recreational components of those lands, it is desirable to have better consistency here in terms of how we sort of apply those rules. So there's an advantage there.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
So we dealt with this in transportation with all-terrain vehicles. You receive funds from the permitting, correct, of the off-road ATVs or any off-road permits for right. maintaining trails and things like that.
Right.
How do we, to me, this should be dealt with over in transportation, but I've seen them make lots of mistakes wanting to strap people in car seats to four-wheelers, which wasn't a good idea and was overturned. But shouldn't we be dealing with it over there and then with permitting and opening up trails and stuff, and you probably wouldn't have the issues that are happening right now if we had a trail system? Would that be correct or safe to say?
I think we could take that discussion offline if that may be a larger point than we're here to address on this particular bill. Further questions? Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to call up Joe Green, Michael Hunter, and Ed Arenello.
Yes.
That might be the only name I've gotten right on this. I called Heath Heather, so, you know.
I'm sure he wasn't offended.
Yeah. Whoever would like to start can begin.
Okay. Grab the microphone there. Okay, I try to keep mine to 3 minutes. That might be nice. Anyway, I'm asking no on this House Bill 3251, and I represent actually one person. That's just a citizen of Oregon, but I'm an outdoor enthusiast. I came to Oregon in 1976, 37 years.
I'm sorry, I need you to identify yourself for the record.
Michael Hunter?
Thank you.
Okay, sorry about that. I apologize. I came here because outdoor activities, the allure, your streams, your beauty and stuff, brought me from Montana. And what I'm finding is that 37 years later, they're still exactly pristine and beautiful. We haven't heard a thing in all the time that I've been here. I still appreciate all of the beauty here. Now, a basic thing I'm representing, outdoor people, hunters, fishermen, quad riders, bikes, horses, everything. And we're getting a proliferation of restrictions that are killing outdoor activities. They're really compromising them. It kind of destroys the reason I want to stay in Oregon. I think you guys kind of need to evaluate, you know, what Oregon attracted people and what we have to offer them. Nothing that I've seen in 37 years is really detrimented. You know, there's always issues, some little stream or something from a logging or whatever. Those things are rectified by specifics. But nothing we've done in the past has actually improved anything. It's already good and it's still good. So the fish and game people have talked about bulldozing, and this is what they do. Stuff in the streams for salmon and stuff. Have you ever seen it? They bulldoze piles of logs and then cable them in big things. It is, I'm going to use the word butt ugly. I've never done anything like that in my life. And yet they call it stream enhancement. This is not something I want to see in Oregon, and they spend our taxpayer money to do it. I kind of think what's going on here is that they're failing to recognize that we all should be treated equal. Every outdoor activity, regardless of what it is, we have rights to go into these areas and stuff like that. And I don't want to abuse anything like that, but it should be treated as equal. I kind of think that Oregon streams are an equal opportunity employer. They don't discriminate. That's the way I'd like to have people look at it. I kind of have a problem because of the proliferation of all of these attacks on our access to these areas from the streams, the forest, and the roads and stuff like that. And the one phrase that keeps popping up that really, I'm going to say, irritates me is that emergency conditions exist. I know its rhetoric means that we need to take it and implement it immediately after passage, but it also implies that there is imminent catastrophe if we don't pass it. Have any of you ever asked what this catastrophe could be if this thing doesn't pass? I don't think there is one. I mean, nobody wants to qualify that statement. I'd like to see them do it. And then last of all, I guess, a 200-pound motorized vehicle, not necessarily an elk, all they're trying to do is a smokescreen to say that we don't want to do handicap access denial. The only thing that fits 200 pounds is an electric wheelchair. Nothing else is motorized vehicle. And I think that's their smokescreen that's just kind of avoiding an issue if they might bring it up. My 3 minutes are up. I thank you.
To the second, actually. That was really impressive.
Okay.
Next.
My name is Ed Arnold. I'm president of the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association. We have been representing OHV enthusiasts, responsible OHV youth, since 1972. We're here because there appears to be not a plus or a minus, but a lack of clarity on this particular bill. Today, somewhere in the Tillamook National Forest, a person is being written a ticket for crossing waterways, for getting off of a trail, or for doing such activities. And someplace else, they may not be. So this bill definitely needs some clarity. It definitely has been taken care of in many of our forests by other bills. In working with law enforcement, we have found that identification of an issue or of a need or of an abuse is step one. That education is typically step two. Today, it is very difficult to say where these people might be riding if we're just talking about the Elliott National Forest or the East State Lands. It's very hard to identify their specs all over the state. It's very difficult for law enforcement to identify what property they are on or not on.
If you could move just a little bit back from the microphone, it'll just start less.
Sorry.
Thank you.
So, a definition of what is a waterway, where is high water, is it where vegetation starts or stops, is it where the water rises or falls, is it flood situation, is it not, what is normal. In Tillamook National Forest, you'll find that normal is way above road level, washing out bridges. So what I'd like to just say is that we really need to identify and be clear on what we're facing here. And it quite possibly could be a better discussion if it was under the umbrella of what already exists. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir.
Yes, Chairman Daly and members of the committee. I'm here today as a concerned citizen. My name is Joe Green. I'm a retired United States Environmental Protection Agency research biologist, and I've been working in the rivers and streams of the West Coast for years because I'm also a small-scale gold suction dredger. I've been studying the effects of actually mining in rivers and streams since 2004. I'm a recognized authority, and the California Department of Fish and Game invited me down to be on their public advisory committee for their environmental impact report that they just spent $1.2 million on. I've had 30 years of national and international professional experience, and 7 years I was held a courtesy faculty appointment at Oregon State University, and 4 years I was an adjunct professor with the Department of Civil Construction and Environmental Engineering, where I worked in the Hazardous Substances Research Center. It's a cooperative program between OSU and Stanford. I worked in the Ecotoxicology Laboratory. I'm here today to ask you to discard this bill, vote no on it. The Department of State Lands holds a responsibility to permit and enforce activities being addressed in this bill. Without public input on public lands, the Oregon citizen is deprived of their rights. The Department of State Lands Chetco River Rulemaking Advisory Committee has been meeting and taking public comment, which closed January 31st, 2013. So I would really like to see that you don't interfere with that process. What is a Chetco River issue has been made into a statewide issue to impact any waterways in a common school forest lands and the Elliott forest lands. The description in this bill is somewhat misleading because when we contacted Michael Burdick to find out what was the problem, is all he did is provided us with information from the Chetco River Watershed Council that asked for these rules. The Chetco River River Watershed Council that brought forward this complaint has become a discredited extremist environmental organization. And those are not my words. In May of 2012, the South Coast Coordinating Watershed Council withdrew support because of bylaw violations, vendettas against landowners along the rivers, and a general negative attitude toward the public. In January 2013, the Brookings City Councilors vehemently came out against a proposal presented by the CRWC, which is what we're talking about today, to ban vehicular traffic and play in the popular river. They passed a Brookings City Council Resolution 13R999, which, quote, opposes the proposed rule as an attempt to address an environmental degradation issue that is unproven and unduly restricts Brookings residents who have used the Chetco River as a recreational and economic resource for decades.
Sir, if you could wrap up your comments for it.
Yeah, really quick. There was no support. No scientific support for these claims, in particular, that travel will harm the this here. In fact, Fish and Game has in-water work periods that cover the period of time when these automobiles are moving in the river. So that's a safe area where we have no sensitive life stages in those waterways at the time of the year when these people are also out there recreating. And you have the rest.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Any questions, I'd be happy to.
Questions for this panel? Representative Boone?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you just said something about the in-water period in which these automobiles are driving through the river. What automobiles?
Yes, ma'am. Chairman Bailey and Representative Boone, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife publishes a set of in-water work periods for every river of importance And so what that describes a safe period of to work in the environment where you do no significant harm to any life stages. It's mostly protective for salmonids, of course. So even the gold miners, they work within that window. If you wanted to build a bridge out in the river, they're going to work within that window. And when these people are driving across that river, it's just by chance. The water has to be low enough. The velocity has to be low enough. And that this accidentally falls within those safe work windows.
Okay. Thank you. We have one more panel.
I just wanted to ask if you have or can provide scientific information, same question, that permanent environmental damage results from.
Yes, I do, actually. I would have to approach it from the mining issue. But the small-scale gold suction dredging is harsher than driving through with a car. And in 1994, the California Department of Fish and Game published an environmental impact report that resulted in the effects of that operation as being less than significant. In 2012, under court order, the Department of Fish and Game just published a brand new $1.2 million environmental impact report, which arrived at the exact same conclusion, that those effects would be less than significant. And I can assure you that driving a car across the river is much more significant than a small-scale gold dredging operation.
Thank you. Thank you to this panel. We appreciate your time. I'd like to call up Al Elkias and Tom Quinta.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair. We need hunters in Oregon need to access a hunting area. They need to find game, and they need to recover game, and we think this bill will impede us doing that. So we'd like to be part of whatever process this bill carries on to make sure that we're able to recreate the way we are now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony.
Sir.
My name is Tom Quintel, and I lived in Oregon for 72 years, and like the gentleman said before, I've seen a lot of changes take place in our state. Some of them good, but a lot of them are getting pretty, I'm going to call it radical. There are groups now that apparently want to shut everything off, and that doesn't just mean access with vehicles or mining or whatever, but they're, I don't think in 20 years that I have testified before various committees in the legislature, I have ever seen this type of anti, it's all environmental, putting the clamps on our freedoms, and I'm tired of it. I don't know about you folks. As folks that live in the rural country, I'm talking when I say country, Baker, Southern Oregon, these places are hurting financially, and they keep shutting off so much of our land. I'm kind of, my testimony's here, but I would just like to say a couple things, and then I have a lot of information that I've submitted to your offices and also to the committee here. The Supremacy Clause really gives the access, that's in the grant, and that's in Oregon law too, and it gives access rights to cross this stream. You know, it's funny, I called up Michael Burdick and I said, Mike, what's the problem here? And he said, we got a presentation from the Oregon Land Board and we saw all this devastation of these rigs in the river and all that. And I said, and it's hurting the fish. And I said, Mike, do you know when the fish nets reds are present in the water? What are those? I said, okay, please call up WDF and Deborah. They'll explain it to you. The issue here is you're not going to get a vehicle that can cross a stream when it's high water. It's suicide. You wouldn't do that. So in low water, you have an opportunity to use an access, cross the stream, and up on the other bank. Now, that's a right-of-way. That's a road. And that's in RS-2477. That's a right-of-way. One of the things, I know this testimony has to be short, so I'm going to get right to the point here. You know, I hear the fact that we've got all this issue with grease and all this stuff coming off ATVs or whatever. I don't know of anybody that knows of an ATV that weighs less than, most of them are 300-400 pounds. I mean, this 200-pound thing is crazy. Okay, now, this is a beautiful picture here. This is DSL's approval in the Checo River of allowing them to mine gravel, a removal fail permit to allow this to happen. So we're supposed to think now that an ATV that wants to go down the riverbank, which you can't, there's no fish damage there. I don't know. It makes no absolute scientific sense. If they're going to put something forward, let's use some science and talk. If they want to talk about fish, then let's talk about fish. What are we destroying? What are we hurting with this? And they're not doing that. They're just saying it does, it could, it might. Let's talk real here. Let's get the science. Let's make them prove the damage. And the Elliott Forest, where they say they put that in the bill, but it's all waters. If you read the bill, it's all state-owned land or waters. That's what I read in that bill prior to Elliott Forest. So we're talking about all state-owned land. For it has any stream that a person might want to, like the gentleman said, you get an elk down, you want to go cross and get your elk. No, you won't be able to do it. I don't know if you guys...
You can wrap up your testimony.
Okay, I will.
Time has elapsed.
And a herd of elk going across a stream will stir that stream up all times of the year. And I've never heard anybody say anything bad about that. So I just hope, again, that we get serious about looking at some of these bills and put some serious science to them, and then maybe I'd even agree with them. But right now, that makes no absolute sense, okay? Thank you for listening to my testimony. Sorry I didn't interrupt. Representative or Chair Bailey and the rest of the committee members, I really thank you for listening to me. Sorry if I got too feisty.
Wait, feisty is fun. This is okay. Thank you very much.
Feisty is fun at 5.
Okay, close the public hearing on House Bill 3251. Committee, before you stand up and walk away, I will just put in context that as dense as these committee meetings have been, it's going to get worse. And I want to just let you know the context here that we have more bills assigned to this committee than any other committee except revenue and judiciary, and those committees meet every day for 2 hours. We have the shortest committee schedule of any committee and the third most bills. So keep that in mind.
We have to hear all those bills, Mr. Chair.
It does not necessarily mean we have to hear all those bills, but keep that in mind and keep an eye on your inbox. There might be a time when we need to do evening committee meetings. So thank you. Committee's adjourned.
Thank you, guys.